Good morning and welcome to the Jump In Tucson. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, and you're tuning in today for the Engagement Hour. The purpose of the Engagement Hour is to encourage you to get involved, for you to be a productive member of the community of our country. And I'm honored this morning to have with me Speaker of the House, Arizona Speaker of the House, Ben Thoma, who defines that willingness to jump in. Speaker Thoma, it's great to have you on the phone with me today.
Hey, thank you for the invite. It's an honor to be with you.
Real quick, I want to give everybody a little background on Speaker Thoma. His family immigrated to the United States through the immigration process when he was a small boy, and I hope you'll share a little of that story with us, because that is one story you told me at one point that really had an impact on me. He's also a small business owner and real estate broker who initially served on the Peoria City Council before he was appointed to the Arizona State House of Representatives in 2017. He was elected in 2018 to that State House of Representatives and quickly elevated to leadership roles, and has been serving as the Speaker of the House for the last 2 years. He has declared that he's going to run for Congress in CD 8, but he's also elected to stay in his role as the Speaker of the House in this critical year leading into the elections. And that's a topic we'll probably talk about a little later. But Speaker Thoma, I really appreciate you taking your time. I listened to you speak at several committees yesterday, and I know you're busy. And I'd love you to start. Just kind of tell us about your background, how you came here. And this hour is about getting engaged, and I'd love to hear why you decided to get engaged and involved in leadership at the political level.
Sure. Yeah. So to start briefly at the beginning, I was born in communist Romania, as you pointed out, in 1978. When I was seven, I remember the strange people coming to interview my parents and my dad in particular, who we knew that once we had strange people showing up, it was the secret police, and they showed up multiple times. It was clearly going to be a problem. And so mom and dad decided that it was time to get out, and they took a major risk in doing that. Of course, they didn't tell us. They didn't tell anybody. They fled the country, and we found out later when my grandparents came to move us out that she had left a note on the back of a painting explaining what they were going to do. So they made their way, and they ended up in a refugee camp outside of Istanbul for about 8 months or so, then another 3 months outside of Rome, and then they got approval and they came to the United States. By this point, it was sort of mid-1987, and they were told that it was going to be 2-3 years before there was any chance of being reunited with us, the kids. I was the oldest, as I said, when they left. I had a little sister and two younger brothers. But, you know, God is merciful and good, and somehow, and no one really knows how, but we got approval, and we got handed 4 passports and told we had 5 days to leave the country. And this was in September of 1987. So they put us on a plane. My grandma took us and put us on a plane to the United States. It was from Bucharest to JFK. And, nobody spoke English. Myself, again, at this point, I had just turned 9. We came to the United States, and the only person that waited for us was a TWA employee, because they were the airlines that were the connecting flight between JFK and Portland, where my parents were living. So because the U.S. government did not believe my mom, they thought she was going to be, you know, she was being delusional. There was no chance that this was happening, but it did, and that's how we ended up in the U.S. That was in, like I said, right at the end of September. I think it was October 1st was our first full day in the U.S. Of 87, and we spent 9 years in Portland. Then my parents decided they had enough of the rain and depressing weather, and decided to move to a sunny place, and that was here in Glendale, Arizona. And we've been in Glendale and Peoria, and now back in Glendale ever since as a family. Found another beautiful girl that ended up being friends with, and then after a little while we ended up people asked us how long we've been dating, and so we decided to date, and after about a year we got married, and we've been blessed with 5 beautiful girls, and we've been here ever since.
Yes, Speaker, I think that's a sign of who you are when you're raising 5 young women, and so you're completely outmanned, I guess we'd say, in your household. But I appreciate you sharing that story with us, because I think it's a great reminder to many who forget how we live in probably one of the greatest nations in the world, because people want to come here. It just tells you about the opportunities and what they can do. And you've gone on to make both a very successful business owner, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about why you decided then at some point to run for public office in the city of Peoria.
Sure. So to be perfectly honest with you, it wasn't me that was interested in politics. Just to be clear, I've always voted and voted since I was 18 years old. Again, for those of us that left a communist country, you know, anything that's communist or socialist in its intent is antithetical to what we believe. And so it wasn't myself that was involved in politics. It was actually my younger brother that was interested in it. And he had gotten involved with a couple of campaigns starting as far back as 2010. And I thought it was interesting, but that was about it. Well, anyway, somebody came to our office to convince him to run for office in the city of Peoria, where he lived as well. And it didn't work for a number of reasons, but on their way out, since we shared a real estate office together, they said, well, where do you live? And I mentioned where I lived, which happened to be in the perfect area of the district. And so they told me that, hey, well, why don't you run? You know, you're in development. That whole North Peoria area was all about development. And why not, you know, throw your hat in the ring and run for this? You can make a difference. And I'll be honest with you, as I said, I didn't know much about exactly what this would be. They told me it was going to be inexpensive and easy. It was neither of those things. I learned a lot through that process. Made some mistakes as well, again, to fully admit that. But I learned a lot through that process. And what should have been a very short-term appointment and then a final election ended up being, because of an actual mess up in the election process, which this was before 2016 and 2020. But anyway, this was in 2014. There was a mistake in the election that ended up taking a lot longer, and I was in office for almost a year. And then it was already in the 2016 cycle, so ran again for that seat and ended up losing by a hair, by 30 votes, which was very painful and not a pleasant experience. And by the way, it ended up being the most expensive election in the city's history prior to the most recent mayor's election. So a lot happened during that time.
Well, Peoria was definitely a growing municipality back then as well. I mean, expanding, so much expansion's gone up in the west side of Maricopa. But I'm betting that defeat, however painful it was also an opportunity in disguise.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, if I would have won, I probably would have been miserable and wouldn't have been able to do many of the things that I ended up doing. But because I didn't win, I was available, clearly, and I had become known to a lot of the individuals that were involved with politics at the time. And so when this position in the State House became open in 2017, in April 2017, my name came up and they called and asked me to put my name, you know, for another appointment. And I told them, look, the last one didn't go well, so no. But then they called again, and eventually they called my wife and convinced her and that it was okay and it was something to do this. And to my surprise, they ended up picking me, and I've been here in the House ever since. And as you said in your intro, you know, I'd only actually been to the House once before, and it was to chaperone one of the twins, one of our girls, when she was in third grade, because my wife had chaperoned the other one 2 weeks before. So it was my turn to do this, and that's why that was the only reason I even knew where the State House was. But I took the jobs and I took it very seriously, and a lot's happened since, including some of the biggest wins in state history in terms of the flat tax as one example. Also, universal school choice, we're the first to do that, and I was the one that championed that in 2022. So a lot has happened, and a lot of success and a lot of change in a good way for a growing state. And I've done more for Peoria, for example, in this role than I probably ever could have done on the city council.
I think that last point's a great point, Speaker Thomas, because people don't realize how much must go through the state legislature to truly get done for municipalities and give them opportunities. Also, you announced for CD8, and we'll talk about that towards the end of the half hour I've got with you, but you made a decision to stay in your current role in the state legislature and serve as speaker during this year with razor-thin margins in the both the House and the Senate, and in some ways different perspectives even amongst those margins. Can you just tell us why you felt it was so important to stay in that role as a speaker this year with instead of going and starting your campaign for Congressional District 8?
Sure. You know, it was a tough decision. But all we have to do is look at what's going on in D.C. right now. I mean, it's broken. You know, they have very tight majorities, which is actually very similar to what we have. We've had one-vote majorities here in the House for the last 6 years and one-vote majorities in the Senate for the last 4 years. And so, in many ways, we have experience, and I personally have experience working with those very tight margins. By the way, every big thing we've done has been with those one-vote majorities. So, for better or worse, I just seem to be well-wired and well-adjusted to working in this type of environment. And we see that at the national level in D.C., they're having major issues trying to figure out how to make this work with those very same type of margins. So I did not want to leave this state and this House and this legislature in chaos. And that could have very well happened with the wrong mix of people here, with the one-vote majorities, with a Democratic governor now. There are lots of things I care about when it comes to policies that I think make Arizona a great place to live, and so many people agree, which is, by the way, why they're all moving here. I just thought it was my duty to finish my commitment to the state, and I knew it was going to be hard, and I was advised that it was going to be hard, and I've got to be honest with you, it's not been easy. But I think it's important, and I think it was the right decision at the end of the day.
Well, I'm with Speaker Ben Thoma of the Arizona State House of Representatives, and I know there's a lot of folks, myself included, that are glad you have stayed in that leadership role. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with Speaker Thoma to talk about what's still left in this legislative session, as well as his campaign for Congressional District 8. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, and with me today is the Arizona State House of Representatives Speaker Ben Thoma. Mr. Speaker, appreciate you really sharing your story today, because it always catches my heart, my attention, a reminder of what this country, the opportunities it provides people, and I think you're a great example of that. But right now in the state legislature, as we've seen, there's been a flurry of strikers in the last couple of days. You testified yesterday at the House Appropriations Committee. There's a lot that everybody needs to wrap up, including the budget discussion. I just wanted to give you a few minutes to talk about what you think are the critical items that you still have to close out before maybe this session can get to an end and allow those who are running, as there's many of you that are running for office, to focus on your campaigns.
Sure. Well, so first of all, there's nothing abnormal about what's going on right now. It happens every session. You know, at this point of the session, the last week of committees, it's always a time when you see a lot of strikers, as we call it, which are bills that effectively are remade, or almost imagine like a bucket. You basically empty everything that's in it because it wasn't passable before. Nobody would have voted for it, or not enough people would have voted for it, and you fill it with something else that for whatever reason died throughout the process. So that's what happens now at this point. And also, budget discussions are ongoing. Look, I'll be blunt, because I've been blunt in other contexts on this. On the legislature, the Senate and the House have been on the same page for almost 2 months now. We did a lot of work to get to a budget, a framework that we can start negotiations on. However, the governor's office has simply not been ready, and there have been some turnover, to be fair to them, but now really it's been, a few weeks now of just, we need one more week, we need two more weeks. So we have another scheduled meeting with them. Hopefully this time they'll be ready. The meeting is tomorrow, but hopefully they'll be ready to actually start substantively talking about and negotiating a budget. So my hope is that we'll actually get there, but from a process standpoint, you know, the legislature right now is focused on passing these bills that are still here, getting them done, and we're actually pretty efficient this session, more so than we were in sessions past, and definitely more so than the last couple of years prior to the last one. So all in all, I think process is moving. Now, there are some things that are important, as you touched on. I can't tell you all of them because we haven't agreed on all of them, but there are still ongoing conversations regarding the water issue, development. You know, as I alluded to earlier, lots of people are still moving here, and we really have some problems on the housing front, and this moratorium on building outside of city limits has been a real problem from that perspective, and has really hurt housing affordability, which is something that I think we all should care about, because for the first time ever here in Arizona, we're above the national median now on housing, which is hard for us to deal with. So that, in addition to that, you know, we've talked about the border. As you pointed out, I'm an immigrant. You know, I understand why people want to come here, and I respect that, but it's not okay what's happening at the border. The fact that we've created a humanitarian crisis, the fact that on top of that we have, you know, serious fentanyl problems and human trafficking and everything from awful things like sex trafficking to terrorists crossing the border. We absolutely have to do as much as we can on that front, even though it is the federal government's responsibility primarily.
Absolutely. And just last week, Governor Hobbs did veto a bipartisan bill that would have potentially created an opportunity for smaller homes, smaller zoning, fix some of the problems, and maybe increase that that availability and the affordability of the housing in our state. So there are a lot of challenges remaining, and I'm going to assume that a lot of these issues may be addressed during that budget negotiation.
Sure. At the end of the day, you know, the budget is the most important and only constitutional duty we actually have as a legislature. We have to pass the budget, as I know you're aware. And so often big issues, whatever they happen to be for any particular session, end up getting resolved with or right around the budget. So I don't think that's going to be any different. I just, again, it's my hope that that the governor's office have gotten their ducks in order, if you will, and that they'll be ready to actually get there with us over the next, you know, few weeks.
No, absolutely. And it's not only the requirement that you pass a budget. A lot of folks don't realize that one of the big differences between the federal government and the state is your budget has to be balanced.
Correct. That's actually a very big difference, because that's been part of the problem in D.C. The fact that they can continue to print money and spend way more than we have has actually led to really bad behavior where members are asking for more and more and more, and no one's actually looking at the bottom line. But we here at the state level, again, can't spend more than we have. We have to have a structurally balanced budget. We can't print more dollars. I am absolutely against borrowing at this point, even though we do have a deficit. I think we absolutely should be scaling back some of the appropriations that we've already done in years past that have not actually moved forward. They haven't been ready to move forward. We can hit delay on some of those and reprioritize some of the dollars that we spent before, which we can easily do. If there's a will, there's a way. And that's true at any level of government, and it's especially true for us here. So that's what we should be focusing on. And the good news is that actually 2 years out, the budget projections are very good. So structurally, we're in a very good place as a state, even though, you know, my flat tax took hold, and I understand that reduced state revenues, but it also increased our investment from outside the state. More companies have moved here, more people have moved here, and so we've actually have record revenue at the end of the day, and that's what we need to do.
And Speaker, you alluded to some of the things you're concerned about on the federal level, so we've got about a little over a minute and a half remaining, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about why you decided to run for Congressional District 8 and why you think you would be the best replacement for Representative Lesko.
Sure. Well, I touched on this before. First and foremost, the border. We absolutely have to secure the border. We're not going to be able to do the things that we need to do on immigration, for example, and have those tough discussions until we actually secure the border. In addition to that, we have very serious problems on the financial front. We've talked about this briefly and kind of touched on it, but we've got record inflation. Some of that is coming back or being cut back now, but really the fact that Social Security is projected to be bankrupt in 7 years, 7 to 10, depending on who you believe, that's a major problem. We need somebody in D.C. that's willing to do what I've done here at the state level, which is roll up your sleeves and do the tough work behind the scenes and stop trying to just post on X or Facebook or stop self-promoting and actually get the work done. So appreciate it. And that's, at the end of the day, you'll know them by their fruit. That's what matters, right? What you've actually done, not only what you're saying you're going to do. What's important. That's what I proved at the state level, and that's what I'm going to do in Congress.
Absolutely. Speaker Toma, sir, I greatly appreciate you spending time with us this morning. Best of luck, and I hope to have you back on the show later in the year. So that was House Speaker Ben Toma, candidate for CD8, and you're listening to Wake Up Tucson. Sorry, Jump In Tucson. I get that wrong every once in a while. Good morning and welcome back to Jump In Tucson, not Wake Up Tucson, although I will be on with Chris tomorrow from the 7 to 8 o'clock hour. His show doesn't need any more, you know, props putting him up. He's got an incredibly long, loyal following, and it's always interesting to be on his show. But you are listening to Jump In Tucson. Specifically, you're listening to the Engagement Hour. And purpose of this hour is to really encourage people to get involved. We're a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality, and with that comes some rights and responsibilities, and that includes being informed and involved. And quite often we find a lot of those folks that step into those roles are those who have immigrated, or their families quite often have immigrated to this country. But this hour I'm going to be able to spend with Tony Penn. Tony's the president and CEO of the United Way of Tucson in Southern Arizona. Very well known throughout this community, a former man of the year. But Tony's got a long, distinguished career of service behind him. And we're going to explore that initially before we get into some of the issues. And Tony, I really appreciate having you on the radio with me today.
Well, it's really great to be here. And it's great to be able to share with your listeners on Jump In Tucson.
Absolutely. So the one thing many may not know about you is the first time you decided to serve.
Yeah.
You may have done service as a young high school student or a young man.
Yes.
But
mm-hmm.
The first time you put up your hand and served, mm-hmm. you joined the United States Air Force.
I did.
Kind of give me a little background of growing up and why that led you to make that decision.
Well, Ted, actually, I've been goal-oriented for the majority of my life. Enlisting in the U.S. Air Force helped me to be able to accomplish three goals. The three goals, Ted, were, first of all, education. Second goal was service. And then the third goal was discipline. I actually was going to college, studying engineering, and ran out of money, Ted, because I was... actually working my way through college. And as it turns out, my opportunity to be able to enlist in the Air Force gave me the chance to be able to accomplish those three goals. I got the chance to be able to finish my engineering degree. And it was the Community College of the Air Force that many of those credits.
Did not know that. That's outstanding.
It was many of those credits that helped me to be able to finish that engineering degree. Finished it with electronic systems and then a minor in actually Christian studies. Ted, so it was being able to accomplish that. Secondly, as I mentioned, as far as those goals are concerned, is a heart for service. And you're right, Ted. Growing up in a very socioeconomically challenged community in inner city Cleveland, Ohio, gave me an opportunity to be able to see, Ted, from my beginning and my roots, that there were a lot of needs. Those needs, of course, were initially part of my growing up, but also, Ted, it gave me a heart for service, which I continue today. Then that third goal was that I was a young man who actually could use a little discipline.
That's the part that I find hard to believe. I mean, I know that the Air Force could help instill that in you, but knowing you, the man you are today,
yes.
I find it hard to believe that at some point in your life you weren't disciplined. What was your role in the Air Force, and how many years was your total service?
Actually, I did... 3.5, Ted. I had actually signed up for a full 4 year, it was the training in the Air Force that opened up significant doors for me because I studied cryptographics and I became a cryptographic technician and studied
Before your time.
Foreign technology. which was really great, which really blended well with my electronics engineering degree. And I got recruited out, Ted, early, and went to work for the National Security Agency on a brief contract overseas. And that gave me the opportunity to begin my engineering work.
Well, I can tell you, if you were recruited by NSA, the your work in the Air Force was recognized as you had a talent and a skill. A lot of folks don't understand. You're such a legend in a lot of ways in this community, in the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. But you did work in the for-profit sector for a while.
And
kind of talk about just how that prepared you for your nonprofit?
I did. I actually, Ted, worked for Teradyne Corporation. Started out as an engineer. Spent 22 years at Teradyne. Teradyne's a process engineering company worldwide, headquartered out of Boston. But, Ted, that gave me the opportunity to be able to go from field engineer to senior engineer to principal engineer and eventually regional manager, and managed a 14-state area for Teradyne Corporation in their support of electronics manufacturing over those 14 states. And I managed about 125 customers, household names like IBM, Dell Computer, Raytheon was one of my big customers in the support area for Teradyne Corporation for 22 years. But Ted, during the late 1990s, early 2000s, when manufacturing at that period started to move offshore, some of us who were senior level executives, mid-level executives, we had to follow that manufacturing, and that was either to go to Singapore or China or wherever that manufacturing was moving. Did I still had two sons who needed a dad, and versus being gone for 6 or 8 weeks at a time, Ted, one of the best decisions of my life at that time was either to take the package or get on a plane. Ted, I took the package.
And I think that is something that has been incredibly beneficial for the nonprofit world, because I believe after that you made your first step. And if you can just touch that before we go break on what that first step into leading in the nonprofit sector.
Well, I like to call it my transition, Ted, from success to significance. As I went from being in the for-profit sector to the nonprofit sector, and at that time I went to work for the YMCA of Greater San Antonio, who needed some leadership around being able to build new YMCAs in the San Antonio and Central Texas metropolitan area to help us catch up with other municipalities who went to the new business model of building new Ys in suburban communities, running surpluses, and then taking those surpluses back into the urban communities to do mission.
Well, and there you have it. That was the beginning of the nonprofit sector. When we come back from break, we'll continue to speak with Tony Penn, the CEO of the United Way of Southern Arizona, and we'll talk about what he's got going on here. And first, before that, how he got here. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson. This is the Engagement Hour, and we look forward to continuing the conversation on the back end of the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson, the Engagement Hour. For those of you who have been listening, you've recognized that voice. If you know him, you know the voice, and that's because my guest today is Tony Penn, the president and CEO of the United Way of Southern Arizona. Great background story. I told Tony during the break, I did not know how extensive your for-profit work with Teradyne was. Mm-hmm. And he did inform me that there was a fourth goal when he entered the Air Force, and that was to see the world. And in typical Air Force fashion, after they trained him, they sent him right back to the base closest to his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. So you didn't fit that one. But you've gone on and done just incredible service to the communities. You're a true leader in that respect. You understand both the business side of it, the economic side of it, and the others. So what brought you to Tucson?
So, Ted, again, thanks to you and thanks for your listeners for this opportunity to be with you today. I did accomplish that fourth goal of seeing the world, but it was with Teradyne. Okay, Teradyne sent me all over the world, which was great. But as I made that transition from, again, success to significance and went to work for the YMCA, the goal there was to be able to execute the new business model, which was to build YMCAs in suburban communities where we could drive membership. And it was the fee-based revenues from those memberships that we were able to take those surpluses and go back into urban communities and do the mission work. And Ted, the goal there was to build six new YMCAs. We did that in 9 years. And Ted, we added 75,000 families to our membership. But then we went back into the urban communities where we had six dilapidated Ys. And we refurbished every one of those with the same paint, same programming, but with subsidies now to be able to scholarship people into membership. Ted, and my work there was done in San Antonio. And being very goal-oriented, it was time to look for my next adventure. And as it turns out, my next adventure was here in Tucson with the United Way of Tucson in Southern Arizona, who was looking for a new leader at that time, and I had the privilege to be able to come serve here in Tucson.
Well, San Antonio's loss was our gain. We know that. So transitioning from the mission of the YMCA to the mission of the United Way, what was your biggest surprise, and what is it that, what are the issues right now that you're most proud of and you're working on? Because there's a lot of issues the United Way takes on.
It is. And as a United Way here locally, we're part of a network of United Ways across the planet. United Way, as many of you know, is a multinational network of organizations. We're in 35 countries, Ted, but here in Tucson, we are the United Way of Tucson of Southern Arizona. The best thing I can tell you about our United Way is we touch the lives of more than 420,000 kids, families, and seniors across the region this past year, Ted. And but we did not do it alone. We did it with the support of the business community, healthcare sector, and many partnerships. Plus, Ted, being able to help fund 80-plus nonprofit organizations is a big part of the work of United Way.
One of the things that I did not realize you did earlier, and I think it was at a Breakfast Club meeting that you talked about and you brought folks in, you actually help with financial literacy, especially around the time of filing for taxes.
We do.
So we're in tax season.
We are.
So if you can kind of just a quick blurb on what that program is in the United Way and how it supports and makes a difference.
That is our VITA program, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. In fact, your United Way of Tucson and Southern Arizona is the largest tax preparer in the state of Arizona. We prepare more taxes than any other single entity around the state, and we don't do it in just Southern Arizona. In fact, Ted, the Hopi tribe, who lives on the floor of the Grand Canyon, has their taxes prepared by United Way of Tucson in Southern Arizona.
That I would not have guessed.
Yes. In fact, we help them, the 400-plus members of that indigenous population, because we, Ted, not only focus on our work in the challenge zip codes around the region, we actually focus on being able to help the indigenous population all over the state. And that's one example of that. But we do those taxes for free. And last year we did about 16,000 tax returns, brought back $21 million out of Washington, put it back into the pockets of hardworking Arizonans, Ted, where we, as you mentioned, get the opportunity to do the real goal, and that's to help create financial wellness throughout the community. Largest paycheck that many of these folks are going to receive all year. So, Ted, we combine that with financial literacy training. We combine it with some folks get their first bank account, learn to balance a checkbook, learn to have a budget. And I've seen folks come in thinking they were getting their taxes done for free, Ted, and they become homeowners for the first time and break the multi-generational poverty line, and for the first time can start to build wealth.
And not only build wealth for the families and the individuals themselves, but people sometimes forget that the more money we receive back in the state contributes to our economy.
And yes, it absolutely does. And Ted, you asked about one of the biggest challenges and concerns right now is that, first of all, Ted, I don't get to pick the issues as the leader of United Way, nor does my board. It actually is the community who gets to pick which issues your United Way is going to attack. And we do that through strategic planning. And we just finished a brand new strategic plan.
You got to love strategic planning.
We do. And after listening and learning from the community what the issues are, Ted, we heard very loud and clear that our two strategic initiatives of educational attainment is something we'll continue to do. Financial wellness, like you just heard, related to the VITA program and other programs that we're involved in, but two new strategic initiatives, and that is healthy communities and being able to focus on access to health care. But then the last one, which even Speaker Toma mentioned, is a priority at the state level, and that is housing stability and homelessness has become a strategic imperative for your United Way.
Well, there's no doubt. I have no concern that my guest, the Tony Penn, the president and CEO of the United Way, is afraid of taking on any issue. Those are some pretty big issues.
They
so what route or what access is the United Way going to approach those issues?
Always with the focus on collective impact. Ted, as you mentioned, those are huge challenges. And Ted, we can do a much better job of being able to make a true impact on those issues when we do them together. And so it is the opportunity to be able to convene and bring communities together around these issues that we've seen our best results. The analytics and metrics that it takes to be able to know that we touch the lives of those 420,000 folks, because I can't help it, Ted, I'm a recovering engineer, as I mentioned before. So we measure everything at the United Way, and it's about data-driven results and data-driven solutions. And so as we come together, cross-sector, business, and the nonprofit sector, social service sector, healthcare sector, education sector, all come together. And Ted, even great organizations like SALC, who are contributors to our work at United Way, as we come together, we can solve these problems, and we can do it in a collective way, which is sustainable. But also helps people be able to get to that level of being able to really, truly break the cycle of multi-generational poverty.
Absolutely. And we've talked about this in the past on this show and in the work I do with SALC and the Southern Arizona Leadership Council. Poverty is a big issue in this region.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is. Our poverty rates are remaining high, and we need to address those. The focus of this show is to get and encourage people to get engaged and get involved. So you just talked about collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's obviously with organizations which people may be involved in, but how can folks who maybe aren't involved, and after listening to you, they go, hey, that's an issue I care about, how can they get involved and help you out with your mission?
Well, Ted, I'll keep it simple. And three T's: time, talent, treasure. Time, talent, treasure. To get engaged and get involved, volunteer. And that's the best opportunity. Your United Way has the largest volunteer engagement event that happens annually. We call our Days of Caring. In this past year, we had over 2,000 volunteers who came out on 2 days, Friday and a Saturday, and did 140-plus work projects all over the community that made a tremendous impact. But it doesn't end there, Ted. It's our goal and our focus to keep those folks engaged as we take them from casually connected to fully committed to making a difference. And those are the folks that I'm speaking to today. And how do you get engaged? Go to our website, UnitedWayTucson.org, push the volunteer button, and there you will find an opportunity to actually genuinely get engaged. That's time. to talent. I'm speaking to many people who have great talents around being able to get things done. Some folks who've retired well and retired early. That's who the folks who are actually helping us do our vital work. People who retired from financial services, and they bring those talents, and we can tell you and direct you to be able to utilize those talents in doing the work of United Way. Then finally, as I mentioned, as you go to our website, there's a give button, and there you punch that give button and you get a menu of opportunities in which you can actually give to your United Way to help us to be able to have the resources that we need to be able to continue our positive trajectory of impact and make sure that we are the organization that is making that work happen. But it's because of our collective impact strategy of bringing communities together.
Well, Tony Penn, thank you very much for what you do this for this community, for your leadership and your continued support. You've made the case once again about the importance of everybody to be engaged and involved. So thank you for taking your time with me today on Jump In Tucson.
Go to UnitedWayTucson.org.
And let's not forget, it's an important week for basketball. So bear down, go Cats, and we'll talk to you next week on Jump In Tucson.